like to start by thanking the organizers for letting me talk today. And what I'll be talking about is our recent work on precision spectrum manipulation of optical pulses using a coherent memory. In our case, the gradient echo memory, or GEM scheme. And by us, I mean the quantum optics group at the Australian National University in Canberra. So I'd like to start my talk by describing why we'd actually want to do this sort of thing, perform these operations, then briefly go about how we do this with the gradient echo memory scheme, and then present our recent experimental results to you. So, why do we want to do this? Why do we want to perform spectral manipulation of optical pulses using a coherent memory? I guess the two main reasons we've come up with, firstly, for quantum communications, where, I guess, simply speaking, if we increase the bandwidth of a pulse, or a time some pair of time bin qubits, so i.e. we shrink them space temporally, we can ideally increase the processing power or processing speed of a system, a quantum information system. And there's a great paper last year by Moisiev and Tittle that did a lot of theoretical work investigating this in a system really similar to the one that we use. So you take a pair of time bin qubits, put them into your memory, and if you squeeze them and they come out temporally, you can actually increase bit rates, I think, this way. Apart from that, when we think of quantum memories, not only the uses we give for them are in repeaters and quantum computers, and in particular linear optics-based quantum computing for optical memories. So I guess the idea here is we replace these sort of delay lines in a quantum computer with memory so we can recall on demand when we want it to. But wouldn't it be great if also while we've got light trapped inside these memories, we could then perform operations on them, so sort of frequency multiplexing of time bin qubits. That's sort of what we're after here. What's out there? What couldn't do this sort of thing? Well, in terms of quantum memories, I guess some of the main candidates are EIT, or electromagnetically induced transparency, with efficiency of over 40% demonstrated in storage times of roughly 1 second. There's AFC, atomic frequency comb scheme. For people who came to Neil's talk on Wednesday would have heard all about this. But in this scheme, I guess the best efficiency is around 35%. And they have quite large bandwidths here, so they can store a large number of pulses. So I think they've published papers of 64 pulse stories, but again, Neil was saying that now it's over 100, I think, in total. There are the Raman-style storage schemes, with efficiency of about 30%, and again, large bandwidths in the order of gigahertz. And then there are the CRIB, which is Controlled Reversible Inhomogeneous Broadening, or GEM schemes, so sorry about all the acronyms on this page, which is the work that we do, and I hope most of you came to Ben's talk on Wednesday, because I'm going to go over some of the same stuff again very quickly. But in our rubidium hot atom system, we've demonstrated efficiencies of about 87% with 20 pulse storage. But there's another group at ANU who do work on solid state systems, and they've got 70% efficiency with their system. But all these memories really want to preserve the input state. They want to keep the state the same at the output and the input. That's sort of the idea. In terms of manipulating the input state, I guess probably the main experimental work that people would know is this work by Novakova on EIT, where pretty much by shaping their coupling field to this red line here, they can change the shape of their output pulse from, say, a Gaussian to a sort of ramp function like this. And in the same paper, they demonstrate how they can take one input pulse and turn it into a pair of time bin qubits at the output. We can also perform this sort of operation in our system. I think Ben showed again on Wednesday the ability to stretch your compressor pulse. He also showed that we can use a sort of random access nature to our memory. We can recall pulses at different times than we sort of want to, and the idea of beam splitter operation to recall, say, half pulses from the memory. We want more. We want to go beyond this. And before I talk about how we do that exactly, I'd like to briefly recap the idea of the gradient echo memory and how it works in general. So for those of you here on Wednesday, this is eerily similar to Ben's talk. What I want to do is just emphasize the importance of the gradient in the gradient echo memory scheme. So the idea is we take an ensemble of two-level atoms and we apply some form of linear frequency gradient to them. So an electric field, a magnetic field, or even an optical field could do this. We then take our pulse, and we send it into the memory. And due to the linearity of the field, different frequency components, we thought different spatial locations along the memory. So for instance, high frequency components we stored on this side, through to low frequency components on that side. This makes GEM a sort of frequency encoding memory, which is really handy for what we want to do, and I'm going to come back to that on the next slide. To recall the pulse, all we have to do is reverse the gradient. This causes rephasing of the dipoles and photon echo from the memory. Now, not only is the gradient responsible for the re-emission of the pulse, but it also provides some handy features for GEM. The first of those is that it allows for, at least in theory, up to 100% recall efficiency in the forward direction due to the monotonicity of the gradient. So this is because we don't have any reabsorption of the pulse. So if you imagine this atom here, this red atom, when it emits its photon, won't run into any other red atoms as it leaves the memory, so there's no reabsorption there. Also, the size of the gradient, so if you make this larger or shorter will determine the bandwidth of the system, i.e. what frequency range we can store. So on the flip side of that, the larger the bandwidth, the lower the efficiency. As you can imagine, there are less atoms at any individual frequency to absorb the light. And that's what limits our bandwidth to, I think, about a megahertz or so. So coming back to this idea of Fourier transforming and frequency encoding, if we take now a more exciting pulse, so say a carrier with two sidebands, a modulated pulse like this, and we store it in our memory, so here is the space coordinate, and this is our memory here, and this is the time axis without any labels. And we send our pulse into it and look at the atomic excitation, we can see if we take a cross-section of that the pulse isn't stored as its temporal profile. It's stored as its Fourier transform. So we've got carrier and two sidebands. And like I said, this is really handy for us because if you want to just, say, select one frequency component, all you have to do is be able to access this one spatial part of the memory, or that one or that one. And that's sort of the idea of this work. How do we go about doing it? Well, here's the setup that we use for our GEM scheme. So firstly, we actually use three levels rather than two. So we couple the two ground states of rubidium-87 atom, which are about 6 megahertz apart, with a strong coupling field and a weak probe field. And these are both detuned by about 3 gigahertz from the excited state. What we do is we combine them on a ring cavity, so the probe beam, the information on the store, passes through the ring cavity, coupling field bounces off, and they go into our memory where we store them. And we use magnetic field gradients for our rubidium atoms. When we recall the light, it passes through a rubidium-85 cell, so this is our way of filtering out the coupling from the probe field. What we do is we have the control field is actually resonant with the rubidium-85 transition of the probe, which is far detuned from that, is not, so the probe passes through, and we mix it down with a local oscillator signal at about 3 megahertz detuning to allow us to perform heterodyne measurement. Now, how do we create these gradients? Well, in, I guess, normal GEM storage, what we do is we use a pair of coils like this, which have variable pitch along them. So you put current into one coil, create a gradient like that. Put current into the other coil, create a gradient like that. But that's not good enough for us anymore. We need, I guess, greater precision in our ability to manipulate the gradient. So what we've done is gone from this sort of scheme to one like this. It's not only much prettier, but it does have much greater control of the gradient. So we have 8 separate coils along the memory, each with about 4 turns. And we can apply different currents to each of these coils to create, I guess you call, funky gradients. And I should point out here that all the controls for these currents in the coils and the experiment, all the switching, et cetera, is controlled via a LabVIEW code, which is published in this paper here and is available from our website if anyone's interested and likes LabVIEW, which isn't very many people. In terms of the gradients we can create, this is an example of a few. I sort of put them up, but you're going to see a lot of these in the next few slides. So along the x-axis here, we have position along the memory. So this is about a 20-centimeter long cell for us. On the y-axis, we have the detuning caused by the magnetic field we've applied. And there are 3 lines on each graph. There's the blue dotted line, which is the gradient we want to create. There's the red line, which is the gradient, the best gradient we can actually create with the actual experimental setup that we've got. And the points themselves are actual measured magnetic fields along the coils. So you can see that the first and third ones, they all match up really well. But for the second one, it doesn't quite work as well. So this is where the precision of our gradient creation sort of breaks down. And we've tried to avoid that in the experimental results I'm going to show you. So that's how we do all this. What can we do with it? I guess the first operation I want to show you is this idea of frequency shifting, so changing the frequency of a pulse. So here we do the same thing we normally do. We take a pulse, we send it into the memory. We flip the gradient. But we also, in this case, add an offset to the gradient. This means that when the pulse exits the memory, it comes at a different frequency. And the change in frequency of the pulse is dependent on the change in offset of the gradient. And here you can see some experimental results. So, like I was saying, we have our input gradient, and then our original output gradient with no offset. And what we then do is we change this offset by about, I think, 100 milligauss, which is about 140 kilohertz, in steps up to about 1.4 megahertz detuning. In the second plot here, you can see the demodulated heterodyne signal. So for those of you who don't really know, heterodyne signal is pretty much a Gaussian envelope with some sort of modulation underneath it. What we've done is we've used Mathematica to fit the phase and frequency of the modulations, then demodulate it, and we take about 100 shots of this, and then we average them all together to get these sort of plots, where the points themselves, the actual measured experimental data, and the dashed lines are fixed to that. So in red here, we have the amplitude of the input pulse, which is actually divided by a factor of 2 to fit on the same scale. And then once we flip the fields, we have our output pulse in blue. So the first thing you can see from this is the efficiency is actually not very high. So it's about 40% amplitude out, so it's about 20% efficiency around there. But that's not really an issue for us at the moment. We're not caring about quantum measurements now. And what we did is from this fit we did in Mathematica of the phase and frequency, we then plotted out the change in frequency of the output pulse compared to the input pulse against this change in offset. And you see we get this nice straight line, which is thankfully what we expect in this case. So this operation works quite well. The next one we want to look at is the idea of gradient shifting. So again, we take our pulse and we send it into the memory. We flip the gradient. But this time we can recall with either a shallower or, in this case, a steeper gradient, which means the pulse is either going to be stretched or, in this case, compressed temporally. And again, here are our experimental results. So we have input gradient, then output gradient with the same ratio. But then we can increase that gradient up to a factor of 3 times larger than the input gradient, or at least we did with our setup. And again, we've got our input pulse, and then output pulses for, this is a 1-to-1 ratio, and then an 8-to-5, and then a 3-to-1. So you see how the pulse gets narrower and narrower as we increase this, the recall gradient. It also comes out sooner because the dipoles in this case rephase faster. Now we sort of expect, after doing some math, we sort of expect, that if we plotted out the Fullerton maximum of the output compared to the input, against the input gradient versus the output gradient, we get a nice straight line, which in this case we don't actually have. And what's really interesting, I guess, for us is that if we look at the same input gradient to output gradient ratio, so one here, we expect the size of the output pulse to be the same as the input pulse, which, as you can see from those two, is not the case. So what we think is going on here is we're having extra dispersion inside the system. It's a very dispersive system. We've got very sharp cutoff and absorption at either end, and our pulse really just fits inside the bandwidth is defined by our gradients. I think this is affecting our system in some way. So it's still linear, still sort of linear, but maybe with a steeper gradient. Next, now we move into, I guess, more exciting sort of operations, and this one is frequency stripping or extraction. So the idea here is we take some sort of modulated pulse, and we send it into our memory. In this case, it's a carrier with a couple of sidebands, which, as I sort of said before, is when you take the Fourier transform, it's got the carrier and the two sidebands at either side stored in the memory. Then what we do is we really slowly flip the gradient. It's sort of a Mexican wave sort of gradient change. And this means that when we look at the output of the memory, we actually recall the pulse as its Fourier transform in time. But of course, we don't have to do that. We can change the gradient in different places and only recall certain components of that, the frequency strip stuff. So you can see what we've done. We've taken, in this case, firstly, just a Gaussian envelope, which is shown there, which contains two different frequencies. And the idea is we store one in this first part of the memory, because of bonded tuning, and one in the second part of the memory up here. Then by reversing, say, the first part of the memory only, so we just don't care about the second part, we leave it flat, we can recall the first frequency component. And then flipping the second part of the memory, we can recall the second frequency component. They come out at the same frequency in this case because we've changed the offset again. We can, of course, go further, and this shows 3 pulse storage. So we've taken, I guess, a carry with the 2 sidebands, which we're talking about a lot. We've got an even steeper gradient now, so our efficiencies are now getting quite low. This is because we're increasing the bandwidth of the system quite a lot. We're really at the sort of breaking point of the whole system at this stage. But it's the same idea, so all pulses stored, 1, 2, 3, then out, 1 pulse out, 2 pulse out, and then all 3 pulses out. Now, with our modulation, in this case, we actually had the same power in all 3, so in the carrier and the 2 sidebands, which is not what you're seeing at the output. And the reason for this is, what Ben was saying the other day, is scattering due to the coupling field. So our strong coupling field that makes our 2-level atom also induces a lot of scatter to the excited state, and therefore loss in the system. And normally, we keep this field off for anything but storage and retrieval. But unfortunately for, say, this third pulse over here, the coupling field's been on for about 10 microseconds before it comes out, and that gives us a lot of loss in the system. But of course, we don't have to recall all pulses. We can choose which ones to come out. That's sort of the idea of this. So let's say we just use the first and third gradients. We could recall just the 2 sidebands, which is the blue trace here, or if we really wanted to, we just recall the carrier, so we just use this gradient here, and then we get the green trace. So we do get a little bit of the last sideband coming out on the end there. Now for my final set of operations, I want to look at the sort of opposite effects, so taking 2 initially time-separated pulses and combining them in the output. So firstly, looking at different frequencies, so we take one pulse, and we only really turn on the storage for one half of the memory, so we've only got one gradient here and nothing over there. So the pulse enters and is stored. We then change our system around a little bit and take a second pulse, a different frequency, and store it in the second part of the memory. Then, by getting your timings just right, and this is quite difficult, it shouldn't be really, and they come out overlapping in time, and therefore they're going to interfere. And this is shown here. So, like I was saying, one pulse in, second pulse in, both recalled. On the demodulation signal, we have the first pulse, the second pulse, and here you can see the interference between the two. In the little inset here, you can see the actual thing. That's just the first pulse going in green and the second in blue. What we then did is we did all this fitting in Mathematica, and we varied the phase between these two pulses and looked at the change in phase of the fit, the output. And I should say that the only factor we changed in our fitting parameters was the phase, so there's only one thing that could change in all of this, and plotted the output fitting phase against the actual phase change we made in our between our two pulses. And you see, again, we get this nice straight line. So again, that's doing exactly what we expect it to do. And finally, look at interference, but this time with frequency, the two pulses of the same frequency, which is slightly more difficult. So we take one pulse, in this case, store it in the second half of the memory, for experimental reasons. We then chain the memory around again, take another pulse, store it in the first half of the memory. Then, again, by getting our timing just right, we can do flip both parts at once and take the first pulse going to here. Now, when they both come out together, they either come out in phase, in which case the pulses will add to give a larger pulse at the output, or they could destructively interfere and create a smaller pulse at the output, which then leaves the system. But of course, we can't lose energy in the system. So what happens is leftover energy is stored in the atomic excitation here. So if we flip the gradient one more time, we can recall another pulse in the system. And we set the area of this pulse to be inversely proportional to the other one, because we only have so much light stored in memory. And that's shown in these graphs here. So again, this is just the sort of gradients that we use. And we have our two input pulses, one slightly bigger than the other one, to match for the fact that we're actually going to have some reabsorption in this case. We no longer have a monotonic gradient. There'll be some reabsorption of the pulse stored over here. And here you can see the outputs. So firstly, we're looking at constructive interference with the blue trace. We've got quite a large first echo and not very much of a second one. And then if we vary the phase again between these two, we can get quite a small first pulse and a relatively large second. And again, by varying this phase and plotting out the areas under the curve, we get these two nice sine waves which are out of phase with each other. So again, what we expect. In terms of visibilities, we're looking at maybe 60% for the first echo and maybe 40% for the second. So not particularly high. This is not really, I think, a fundamental limit. It's definitely an experimental limit. Getting the pulses coming back at the same time and the same size is a real issue. That's mostly what I wanted to say today. So hopefully I've shown you that the GEM is quite useful for these sort of frequency operations that should be used in hopefully some quantum applications. So we've shown spectrum manipulation by changing the offset of a frequency offset of a pulse just by changing the offset of a gradient. We looked at compression and expansion of a pulse. We also looked at frequency filtering, so taking different frequency components at different times. Interference of pulses as well, both different and the same frequencies. In terms of limitations, I guess the main one we've got at the moment is optical depth, so how many atoms we have to absorb the light and therefore efficiency of the system. So all this data has quite low efficiency. And if we want to increase the bandwidth further or store more pulses, we have to improve that somehow. There's also the idea of decoherence. So what I showed you when I was looking at the three-pulse storage is that we lose a lot of efficiency due to this coupling field being on for pulses that are recorded later. And that's really an issue for the system. Apart from that, I guess it's precision of the gradient control. So for the traces we've shown here, we've actually done quite a good job, I think, of making the desired gradient match the actual gradient. But if you wanted to, say, store four pulses at once or do other funky things, you may need better control of the gradient, and that's something to think about for future work. I guess ways to improve this are maybe to use multiple memories. So rather than using one cell as, say, three sub-memories, we could use three cells and count them as one memory, which would improve both optical depth, so many more atoms, and also, I guess, the relative precision of the gradient controls. Apart from that, if we were really, really worried about our gradients and the precision of it, we can move to another gradient mechanism, so say, maybe stark shift or laser intensity shift. We did a lot of work on this last year trying to see if it was feasible. That's about it. But before I finish, I'd like to thank the rest of my group. In particular, Cameron Cairns, who was a second year student with us last year. He spent 6 months working on these coils and making them work properly, which was no mean feat. Maddie, who got the efficiency up to 87% so I could lower it down to 20 again. And Ben, of course, for most of the theoretical work that has gone into this paper, as well as Pinkoy and Daniel, my honor student. So thank you very much.